Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. This month, we have brought you two of our virtual programs since the Reagan Museum closed due to COVID-19. This week, we'll bring you our third program, which was held on June 18, 2020, with Chris Wallace, host of Fox News Sunday. During our virtual discussion with the Reagan Foundation and Institute's executive director, Mr. Wallace discussed his brand new book, Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World. Let's listen.
What a terrific book. I, as you may know, we have a lot of guests that come to the Reagan Library and some with some good books, and I'm not able to read them all. I could not put this one down. This is just a terrific book, Chris, a thriller, really a historical thriller that I just loved it. And so congratulations on not just a first effort, but a great first effort.
Thank you. That's awfully nice. I will say, this idea of the historical thriller, it seems to be out there because my favorite review was one in the Washington Post that said, I know what happened in 1945, but this book is a thriller. And a lot of people have said that, you know, it's a page turner. They couldn't put it down. And I'm thrilled because, frankly, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I think so much history is written, you know, this is in the distant past. We know what happened. Why did it happen? And that's not at all what I wanted to do. I wanted to take you into the moment. And in this case, it's Countdown 1945, the 116 days that changed the world, the key moments in those 116 days from April 12th, 45, when Truman is summoned to the White House. He thinks to talk to President Roosevelt, and then he finds out that Roosevelt is dead, and he is sworn in, and Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, takes him aside afterwards and says, I need to tell you about an immense project to create the most devastating weapon in history, which is the first inkling Vice President, now President Truman, has of the existence of the Manhattan Project. And to take you, not just Truman as he's struggling and making the decision, but the scientists at Los Alamos who don't know whether the gadget, as they call the atom bomb, would even work until 21 days before the bombing, and the flight crew of the Enola Gay, who on the mission, during their mission to Hiroshima, the 1,500 miles to Hiroshima from Tinian Island, don't know if the bomb, when they drop it, because it's never been dropped out of a plane, whether the aftershocks will knock them right out of the sky. So that's what I was trying to do, and the fact that you and some other people, John, have said that it was a page-turner and a thriller, I'm thrilled.
Yeah, Chris, my father happened, he was a B-29 pilot in the Army Air Corps, so I was riveted, as you can imagine. But your father doesn't need to have been in the Army Air Corps to like this book, so you're really well done. You put us in the room where it happens on many occasions, and that's just a masterful job. So well done there, Chris.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's exactly what I was trying to do, and there are so many dramatic moments. Truman, he has a meeting with his war cabinet on June 18th, and Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, is there. George Marshall, the General of the Army, is there. All of the top brass. And they're discussing now that Nazis have surrendered on May 8th, how they're going to finish and win the war against the Japanese. And for about 45 minutes, there's a long discussion of the invasion of Japan, how many troops it will take, how long it will prolong the war, how many hundreds of thousands of casualties there will be on both sides. And at the end, there's quite a junior man in the room, the Assistant Secretary of War named John McCloy, who ended up becoming a major figure in mid-century America. He was the High Commissioner to Germany. He was a member of the Warren Commission. He was the head of the World Bank. But he was a junior guy there. And Truman says, nobody gets out of the room, McCloy, without telling what they think. And McCloy asked Henry Stimson, his boss at the War Department, And Stim says, go ahead. And he says, well, I think we ought to have our heads examined if we don't at least discuss the bomb. And that was literally, in this war cabinet, the first time in this meeting they'd been talking about the casualties and the length of the invasion and how bloody it was going to be, and nobody had ever said, yeah, but we might have the bomb, until he said it. And basically, it was dismissed at that point, largely because it had never been tested. It wasn't tested until July 18th, just 21 days before the bomb was used against Hiroshima. And at that point, back in June, Truman viewed it as a science project. If it worked, great. If it didn't, you know, we had to go ahead.
Yeah, so many historical moments you wrote about, Chris. I wonder, you know, I know you're a student of history. What is it that made you choose this particular moment?
Well, it's a funny story. I had the idea of doing exactly what I talked about, to take a key moment in history and try to put you in it. You know, at the time, they didn't know all these things. They're faced with these momentous challenges, and they don't know what's going to happen. It'd be like talking about Reagan and what ended up happening in terms of our control with Gorbachev. I was fortunate enough to cover 6 years of Reagan, including all four Reagan-Gorbachev summits. But, you know, having covered it in real life, the drama of Reykjavik and, you know, these enormous discussions and the possibility that they might ban all nuclear weapons, and then it all falls apart. You know, to just say Reykjavik failed is one thing. To say they went there with these hopes and they have this meeting, and, you know, it creates a tremendous sense of suspense. So I wanted to do that, but I didn't have a subject. In February of 2019, it was the day that President Trump was going to deliver his State of the Union address. And Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, invited several of the TV anchors over to her hideaway in the Capitol. And this is the hideaway that a lot of speakers have. And there's a tradition in Washington that if the speaker and the president are of opposing parties, this is true for a Republican president, Democratic speaker, and vice versa, that the speaker will deliver a prebuttal, which is basically before the president even delivers the speech, to tell you all the reasons that it's bad. So we're sitting in this room, and Nancy Pelosi says, this is the Board of Education. I don't think the other folks in the room knew, but I knew that the Board of Education had been Sam Rayburn's hideaway. And this is where he would have people come after hours to gossip or to plot strategy or to have a bourbon and branch water. And Vice President Truman was a regular there. So on April 12th, after he'd finished presiding over the Senate, he went over. Pelosi's telling us this story. She said it was in this room that Truman called the White House. He was told that they wanted to speak to him, and he calls and speaks to a White House official who says, you need to get to the White House as quickly and quietly as possible. And Truman puts down the phone and says to the room, Jesus Christ and General Jackson, and which I had never heard before. And I thought to myself, that's it. That's my story. That's the one I'm going to delve into and try to create a historical thriller. And as it turned out, I didn't know then, 116 days from when he is alerted that Roosevelt has died and he's president until the bomb is dropped on Hiroshima.
Yeah. You know, your first book, Chris, some writers report after their first book, they just had a fabulous time. They loved the experience, and some found it miserable. How did you find writing your first book?
Yes. But, you know, it is a very odd experience. It's a roller coaster. There are times when you get a delicious fact. That's really what is so exciting is, you know, I didn't know that when Truman, you know, I knew the story about Jesus Christ and General Jackson, so I thought that's going to be a good start. But I didn't know when I started the project that when Truman gets to the White House and is sworn in, he is alerted for the first time about the existence of the Manhattan Project. And there's so many juicy little details like that. I mean, one of the details is the fact that they only had tested the bomb once on July 21st, July 16th, and 21 days before they ended up using it. So now they're at Tinian Island, which was the launch pad for the flight to Hiroshima, about 1,500 miles. And somebody says, look, if we put this 10,000-pound bomb, which was very inappropriately called Little Boy, in the front of the plane, and then we have to put a bunch of extra gas in the back of the plane so that it won't fall down, that it'll be more weight than we've ever carried, and the plane might crash on takeoff. And if there's an atom bomb, that we could have an atomic explosion at the U.S. base on Tinian Island, which will destroy all of us and won't do anything to the Japanese. So they suddenly say, this is only about 2 days before the mission, we can't take off with a live bomb. We're going to have to arm the bomb on the plane during the mission. And they turn to the chief ordnance officer, a guy named Deke Parsons, and they say, can you do that? And he says, well, I never have, but I guess I'll learn. So he sits in the plane on the ground in Tinian Island in sweltering heat, working on it, trying to do it. And then when they finally do take off with an unarmed bomb, get off safely, and they're on the way to Hiroshima, he gets down, cradles in the bomb bay next to Little Boy, and he has to take off some of the casing, do some of the rewiring. Then they have to take off the safety plugs and put in the arming plugs. And it is only then, midway through the flight, that they say the bomb is actually armed and ready to go.
You know,
that's
that
the kind of detail that you that you know is just a joy. So I'm go back to your question. So the moments like that, it's a joy. And then there are times, and you're just trying to, how do I tell the story and how do I put all of these disparate elements together? And you think, man, this is hard work. My daughter is in publishing, and at one point, she's been in publishing for 10 years, not at my publisher. There's no reverse nepotism here. But I said to her, boy, writing a book is hard work. And she rolled her eyes and said, gee, Dad, I'm glad you discovered that.
It's tough to make a living. Chris, did it surprise you? It did me that Truman didn't know the first thing about the building of this bomb, you know. And then I'd read, you've written that he and Roosevelt had only spoken a couple of times during this fourth term of the presidency. But it just seems almost inconceivable as a vice president you'd not have been read into something as important as this. But I guess that was the case.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked me about that, and it does seem incredible. He had been vice president for 82 days. And he had met privately, he'd been in some big meetings, but he had met privately with Roosevelt twice in those 82 days. And the fact was that you've got to remember, this was Roosevelt's fourth term. He'd had, this wasn't his first or even his second vice president. So he had gotten pretty good at ignoring vice presidents. And I think he thought, you know, vice presidents come and go, I've got my war cabinet, and those are the people that I count on to make these decisions. And he had just sort of shunted Truman off to the side. And so I mentioned the fact that Stimson takes him aside on the day he's sworn in and says, I'm going to tell you about this project. But he knows that Truman is overwhelmed. He's just become the president. So he says, I'm going to give you some time to settle in, and then I'll come back. On April 25th, 13 days later, he comes into the Oval Office to brief President Truman, now that he's settled in not even quite 2 weeks. And meanwhile, General Leslie Groves, who was the real military commander of the Manhattan Project, is snuck in through underground tunnels. And one of the reasons was they'd given this a lot of thought at the Pentagon. They thought if the two of them come in through the front door together, that people are going to wonder, what are Groves, who had built the Pentagon, so he was, you know, the big mission man, what Groves and Stimson were doing together. And so he snuck in, and they gave Truman a detailed document to read, and which really explained the Manhattan Project in historical detail and technical detail. And Truman complained. He said, I don't like reading long documents like this. And Grove said, Mr. President, we can't say it any more briefly or succinctly. It's a complicated project. And, you know, he that's how out of touch he was with it. But of course, by the end, at the time that it counted, when he made the decision, he knew he had mastered all of it.
Yeah. Another remarkable fact I found from reading your book, Chris, is 125,000 people, Americans, working on this Manhattan Project, and not a word gets out. That's just amazing.
Well, you're exactly right. It's one of the things that astonished me too. And, you know, people say to me, what was it? You covered Trump and you're covering all the ups and downs and the ins and outs of Washington today. You know, what was it like writing about this book? And I said, one of the things I enjoyed most about writing, researching and writing and now talking about this book is it has absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump. Not to say, that's not a knock on the president, it's just to say that it took me away from all the stuff we're in. And it goes precisely to your point, because you're exactly right. They had been working on this project for almost 3 years, 2+ years. 125,000 people at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, uranium enrichment, Los Alamos working on the bomb, war enrichment in Hanford, Washington, flight crews in Wendover, Utah, and not one word leaks about the project. And, you know, I thought to myself, if you had 125,000 people today working on a secret project to bake apple pie, by day two, somebody would tweet, this is outrageous, it's immoral, I'm going to blow the whistle on this thing. It was, John, it was a simpler time. It was a time when the country was more unified, everybody pulled together in common cause to win the war against the Nazis and the Japanese. And, you know, boy, could we use that now.
Yeah, you're not kidding. You're not kidding. Another, I thought fascinating thing about the way you wrote the book, Chris, is, well, of course you covered the major, major figures involved in the project, from Truman to Tibbetts and Groves and Oppenheimer and the rest. But then you also chose to focus in on Ruth Sisson and Hideko Tamura. Yeah. And, you know, tell the listeners about those two, because I thought it was a great juxtaposition throughout the book.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do with this book is I very much wanted, you know, it not just to be on the top level, because of course the war wasn't just on the top level of the scientists. I mean, it would engage all of America. And one of the stories that I wanted to tell was the home front. And we found Ruth Sisson. And, you know, there are websites and where, you know, there is commentary about various people. And amazingly, we found two people who are still alive. Obviously, all of the big players are long gone. Ruth Sisson was a 19-year-old girl. She had volunteered to work at Oak Ridge at the uranium enrichment facility. She didn't know what it was, though. She just knew it was a big factory. And there were these giant machines called Calitron machines. And the women, it was a different time, they were called the Calitron girls. And they basically just had a bunch of knobs that they had to keep the meter in the right place, not go into the red. They had no idea. They were just told, keep the meter in the red and you'll help win the war. They had no idea what they were doing was enriching uranium, creating U-235 and plutonium to fuel the atom bombs. And what made her story especially interesting was not just that she was in the home front, but she had a boyfriend, later her husband, Lawrence Huddleston, who was in Europe, had been an army medic and had survived all the fighting. Well, May 8th, the war in Europe ends, the Nazis surrender, and like a lot of other people, she's delighted because her boyfriend has gotten through this, but she's terrified because he's not going to come home. The expectation is he's now going to be shipped to an even bloodier conflict in Japan. So what she didn't realize, and what was, you know, this kind of dramatic irony of this, is she is creating or helping create the weapon that, if it is used, could save her boyfriend's life. And that's exactly what happened. Hideko Tamura, even more dramatic story. And again, you know, that's one of the great things, as you know, as a student of history, is oftentimes history, there are plot lines that you would never dream of inventing yourself if you were going to write a novel or do a movie. Hideko Tamura was a 10-year-old girl. Her came from quite a wealthy family in Hiroshima. And like a lot of the families all throughout the country, they didn't have any expectation of an atom bomb, but they certainly expected to be bombed. They hadn't been bombed at all. So the parents would send their children out to the countryside so that if there were a bombing, they'd be safe. They sent Hideko, her parents did, to what they thought was a school, but it ended up really being a work camp. And Hideko, who was a very willful 10-year-old, hated it. Well, she couldn't send a letter home because the school censored it, I think, because a lot of the students were telling their parents, get me out of here. So she snuck into the town and she mailed a letter in the local post office saying, get me out of here. Hideko's mother shows up on August 4th to rescue her. And Hideko is thrilled and she runs and, oh, thank you, Mom. And the mother says, Hideko, look, you know, there's a lot of fear in the cities. Let's stay out here in the countryside for a few days. And Hideko said, absolutely not. I want to go home. So they spend the night and they go home on August 5th. And of course, that means that they're in Hiroshima when the bomb is dropped on August 6th.
Just amazing. And in fact, Chris, I had the great chance to see a clip of you and Hideko going into the Smithsonian to see the presence of that massive Enola Gay right there in front of her. What a moment that must have been.
Well, you know, this again is the kind of thing that you never would have imagined. So we did a documentary for Fox News. If anybody out there, and I assume a lot of you do, subscribe to Fox Nation, you can find it there, called Countdown 1945, like the book. And I said to her, we had just talked on the phone up to that point, I said, would you consider coming to Washington for an interview? And she said, I will, under one condition. What's that? I want to go see the Enola Gay. I would never have dreamt or even of asking her to do something like that, but she wanted to do it. So we drove out one day and we got permission to go there before the museum opened. And we went to see the Enola Gay, and I didn't know what her reaction would be. And she was kind of stunned. And as you well know from your dad and B-29s, they're enormous planes, really big planes, Super Fortress it was called. And big, bright silver, all shiny. And we walked up to it, and she was just taking it in. And I said, do you feel anger? And she said, no, I just feel grief. I feel deeply grief-stricken. And she thought for a while, and then she said, I want to say a prayer for peace, which she did. And then she said, I think that he's an old man. I think the plane is an old man, and I think he needs to leave this museum and go to sleep, and which I thought was interesting. And then she went sayonara, and that was that. And I think on some level, it provided some closure.
More from A Reagan Forum with Chris Wallace after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now back to A Reagan Forum with Chris Wallace.
Let's go back to Truman for a second. Yeah, I know it's not easy, but summarize for me the dilemma that Truman faced with the dropping of the bomb, his rationale, because as you described so well in your book, it was going to save a lot of lives, but take a lot of lives as well.
Well, I think there are a couple of points I would make, and obviously this has been one of the great moral questions for the last 75 years. This, of course, is this summer, the 75th anniversary of all these events and the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. Should we have dropped the bomb or not? And I guess I hadn't really studied at it and thought about it. It wasn't a choice between dropping the bomb or doing nothing. It was a choice between dropping the bomb and invading. And if we invaded, as I said, the top experts, General Marshall, Secretary of War Stimson, all of the top people at the Pentagon said, this was in the summer of 45, you can expect the war to go on at least another year and a half until the end of 1946, and you can expect 1 million Japanese casualties and a half a million American casualties, because as they got closer and closer to the Japanese homeland, instead of the Japanese soldiers beginning to lose spirit, they in fact fought more fiercely. When they went to Okinawa, they thought they were going to take it over in 2 days. It took them 3 months, and they ended up having to kill 100,000 Japanese, and the 20,000 that were left, none of them surrendered. Some of them committed suicide. Some of them kept fighting. Some of them were taken prisoner, but they didn't surrender. And so they knew they were going to have a terrible battle on their hands if they did invade. Now, some people say, well, okay, so, you know, but they would have surrendered anyway, to which my response is, we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima on August 6th, and the Japanese military government does not surrender for 3 days. So the U.S. then drops a second bomb on Nagasaki, and the Japanese military government still does not surrender. And it is only then that Emperor Hirohito decides to go over the Japanese government and directly to the people, and he gets on the radio, and it's literally the first time the vast majority of Japanese have ever heard the voice of their emperor, and he basically says, we have to surrender. And that was it. But it took two bombs and an emperor going over the heads of the government to get the Japanese to surrender. You know, I think one issue for Truman, and honestly, I don't know that any president would have made any other decision. You know, if you had invaded, and if you had sent thousands or hundreds of thousands of Americans to their death or to grievous injury, and later it were to come out that you had, as the president, you had access to a weapon that conceivably could have ended the war in a flash, and you had said, I'm not going to use it, I don't know that any president could have faced that or would have wanted to face that. So, you know, I leave it to others as to whether it was the moral thing to do or not, but I think as a realistic, practical matter, I don't think Truman had any choice.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was such a catch-22 at the time. Chris, one of the ways that it feels like you take the reader right into the room on some occasions is the material you've got. It was just excellent. And I wonder, what were your core sources, particularly as it relates to Truman?
Well, I wonder if you're doing this as a commercial. maybe a little bit. After I read all of the histories, and there's a lot of histories out there that are very, very good, you want more. And so where did I go? I went to the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, and I spent a few days there with an archivist, as I'm sure so many scholars have with Reagan, going through these. And the treasure trove was the diaries. Because, you know, I often think to myself, you know, as I covered Reagan in the 80s, as I cover, not as directly, because I spent 6 years in the White House press corps, but as I covered Trump now, you know, what are they thinking at that moment? What's really going on in their mind? Not the press release, but what's really going on? Well, now we have access to Reagan's diaries, and we have a much better sense of that. Well, Truman's diaries were terrific. He really was first of all, a very good diary keeper, as was President Reagan, and also a very good writer, as was Reagan. And he said a lot of things in those diaries that give you the inner conversation. One of the things that I found very interesting is that, and it's different than I think most people's perception of Truman, because he's famously thought of as this very decisive man. The buck stops here. He made a decision and he never looked back on it. Well, he never looked back on this. He always defended it and said he'd do it again. But as he's making the decision in Potsdam, Germany, at a summit conference with Churchill and Stalin in July of 45, he was really struggling with this decision. He was having trouble sleeping at night. He complained of fierce headaches, which he had whenever he was under stress in his career. And in his diary, he keeps talking about this terrible weapon, and he describes it in apocalyptic terms. He describes it as the fire destruction prophesied in the Bible. So you know, he made the decision, and as I say, he never looked back, but this was an enormous decision, and he gave it all of the weight and all of the inner turmoil and struggling that I think he should have. He wrestled with it.
Yeah, tough job to be a president. Robert Oppenheimer, talk to us about him. And I'm sure there's been, you know, extensive, books written about him. What a man. I think as you describe him, a Renaissance figure and a genius, really.
Absolutely. Spoke, I think, a half dozen languages, learned Sanskrit so he could read the Buddhist writings. Fabulously brilliant as a physicist, but also, and people had real questions about whether he would have any executive skills at all, became a very skilled administrator. He was the scientific director at Los Alamos. And one of the things that he had to juggle was he had General Groves, who I mentioned before, this bulldozer of a man and a military man. And then he had all of these, frankly, prima donna scientists who rebelled at the idea of deadlines and military order. And he kind of had to keep both of those things going. You know, we talk about second thoughts. One of these great nuggets in the book is after the bombing and after the war ends, Truman never looks back on it. He says, you know, he's asked about it for the rest of his life, and he keeps saying, you know, I had to make the decision. It ended the war, and if I had to make that call, I'd do it again. All of the people on the flight crew said the same thing, Paul Tibbetts, all of them. It ended the war. We're military men, and this was the way to defeat the enemy. The people who did have second thoughts were the scientists. Albert Einstein really started the whole Manhattan Project in 1939 when he writes a letter to Roosevelt. And what his concern is, and the concern of a lot of the German refugees who'd left Nazi Germany and are now in the West, either in England or in the US, they were concerned the Nazis were going to get the atomic weapon before the US did. And Lord, you know, God forbid that Adolf Hitler had a monopoly on the first true weapon of mass destruction. In any case, so about a month after the explosion, Oppenheimer comes to the White House and he sits down with Truman. And by this point, he's just racked with second thoughts. And he says, Mr. President, I have these terrible regrets. I feel that I have blood on my hand. And Truman says, don't worry about it. I gave the order. I've got the blood on my hands. And they finish the conversation. Oppenheimer leaves, and Truman says to his staff, I never want to see that son of a bitch in this office ever again.
Yeah, it's such a moment. You also tell a story in the book that I had not heard before, and it's and I want you to tell the whole story of the part about the Pulitzer, and it's with respect to this fellow William Lawrence with the New York Times and the opportunity that he had in this project and how all that turned out.
Well, again, you know, this is what the joy, you know, you talk about a good day and bad days writing. This was a very good day. William Leonard Lawrence was a science reporter and a very distinguished science reporter for the New York Times. And he had won a Pulitzer Prize with a group of other people, I think in 37, for writing an article on a scientific project. And Groves, this military man, but he also thinks to himself, this is going to be, if it all works out, an immense story. And I want the story told right. So, and this is another example of the difference between the unity of that time and what we have today. So this military general walks into the New York Times and goes to see the editor, and he says, I would like, because he knows about Lawrence, I would like to get William Lawrence, and I'd like you to detach him, and I would like him to basically disappear off the face of the earth, and I want him to go inside. He's going to get the greatest story of all time. I'm trying to remember. I don't think he told the editor what the story was. I'm almost sure he didn't, nor Lawrence, but he basically, so, and the editor said, okay, can you imagine that today if a general went to the editor of the Times? And Lawrence is told, and he's basically told, you're going to have the greatest story of all time, but you're not going to be able to tell it until, you know, we tell you you can. Well, of course, any newsman, you know, worth a cent would rebel at that. But the idea of the, of this great story, he was intrigued, so he did it. So he then was brought inside, and he hung out at Los Alamos, and he was part of it all. And he was there at Alamogordo when they tested the bomb on July 16th. And he had a genius, and we quote at great length from some of the dispatches he wrote, none of which appeared until after the bomb exploded and Truman announced the whole project to the world. But his writing was fantastic, and he came up with a phrase, maybe you've heard of it before, the atomic age. That was written by William Lawrence. And so he's there for all of the testing, and you know, I wish my writing were as good as William Lawrence's is, but you get to read some of his in the book. And then he's brought to Tinian Island, so he is there with the crews. He's not allowed on the first flight because it's obviously the first flight, and they just had 12 men, and they weren't going to, you know, spare an extra seat. But he does end up going on the second flight, the Nagasaki flight. So he is there and describes as a first-person witness the detonation of the second atomic bomb in warfare. And he's a great character, and it's a delight to read. You know, think about, how do you describe the first atomic bomb blast? How do you describe, which is the test, how do you describe seeing an atomic bomb take out a city? He does it masterfully.
Yeah, sure does. The surprising thing, it's almost like a postscript that you wrote about, Chris, was that I guess there was a movement several years later to pull the Pulitzer Prize from him and the New York Times because of the arrangement that had been made at the time. I thought, well, I would have opposed that, but an interesting story.
Well, yeah, because what had happened was that during that period of time that he was behind the scenes, he was on the government payroll. And so, and again, you know, there was just a different sort of relationship in terms of people, the media, the country. It was much more of a sense that we're all in this together. That obviously has ended. And so at a certain point, I think in the 50s, or maybe it was the 60s, that they went to the Times and said, like, he was basically writing government press releases, you should get back the Pulitzer. The Times and William Lawrence did not.
Yeah, rightly so, I think. Now, there's a bit player that you mentioned, I think maybe only once, but it just leapt off the page at me because I didn't know this as a piece of history, but this fellow, Klaus Fuchs, I think is the German, that was a scientist on the Manhattan Project, actually turned out to be a Russian spy. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, just real quickly. So one of the big issues for Churchill and Truman at Potsdam, because the British and the U.S. had been involved in this all along together, Roosevelt and Churchill and now Truman. So when the bomb explodes, Truman gets word and Churchill gets word almost at the same time. But one of the things they're discussing is, when do we tell Stalin? Because Stalin doesn't know anything about this project, or so they think. And just before the conference ends, and the decision is, look, we don't want to tell him too early, and we don't want to tell him too much, but if we don't tell him anything, then, you know, we're supposedly allies, he's going to resent it, and it's going to create even more problems. And let me tell you, when they're in Potsdam, there already are major problems between Russia on the one side and the U.S. and Britain on the other, because, of course, Russia has swept in from the east and taken over most of Eastern Europe, and they're not going to give it up. So late in the conference, after one of the sessions, Truman goes over to Stalin to tell him about it. And, you know, it's been very practiced what he's going to say. He doesn't even bring his translator. He uses the Russian translator, the translator is Stalin and Truman by themselves. And Truman says, I just want to let you know that we have an enormous, indescribably powerful weapon that we have developed. And Stalin says something basically, well, I hope you'll put it to good use with the enemy. And that's it. And then he turns away. And Truman is dumbfounded. Well, you know, he doesn't ask a question. And Churchill comes up to him and says, because he wasn't there, but he can see that it's a very short conversation, what happened? And he said, I don't know. I told him, and he didn't seem that interested. And even Truman's Russian translator, not the Russian, but the American who was served as a translator, is wondering whether the translator had translated it properly. Well, the story, the truth is that Stalin was interested. He just wasn't surprised because, exactly as you say, there was this German scientist who had become a refugee, had gone to Britain, ended up in the United States. But he had been a member of the German Communist Party because he saw the Communist Party as being the only force inside Germany that was resistant to Hitler. Now he leaves and he's in the United States, and because he was a brilliant scientist, he's working in the Manhattan Project, but his loyalty is still to communism. And so he gives a courier named Raymond all kinds of information, which goes back to the Russians. And the postscript to the entire story is, so later that night, Stalin and Molotov, the foreign minister, end up back in the Russian compound together, and somebody overhears them having a conversation, and in which they're discussing the fact that Truman has now told them that they've got the bomb and the bomb works, and Stalin says, I guess we need to get going. And a historian would later say that at 7:25 p.m. on that night is when the nuclear arms race between Russia and the U.S. officially began.
Yeah, what a moment, what a moment. Well, Chris, do you have another book in you? It seems like you must, because it seemed like you really enjoyed this and it's turned out to be a best-selling book. So what's your next one? Have you already got one in mind?
Well, one of the thoughts I had was to not only do what all the things that I said, create a historical thriller, but to be able to replicate it. And so when I came up with a countdown idea that instead of, telling it as dusty history, but we're gonna count down the days, I thought, well, if you can do countdown 1945, you can do countdown whatever. I have a couple of ideas. I haven't settled on one yet. But yeah, I think I've got, as I said, writing a history book, there are ups and downs, highs and lows, but I think there are enough ups. And one of them, and I'm not just blowing smoke, is getting the chance to talk to you about this book. There'll be another countdown.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to read it, Chris, really. You've got a whole nother career ahead of you. So just wonderful to see the work you've done. And thanks so much for joining us today. Absolutely. Best of luck as you do this book tour virtually around the world.
Yes. And, the virus is going to end and I will be out at one of my favorite places in the world, the Reagan Library. As you know, I've been there many times, including with Mrs. Reagan when she was still alive. And I look forward to coming and talking to all you folks in person.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. You're welcome anytime.
For the past 3 years, Chris Wallace has broadcast his Sunday morning news program live from the Reagan Library's Air Force One Pavilion during the Reagan Foundation's annual Reagan National Defense Forum. It was great to finally be able to sit down with him and have a conversation for an hour. Signed copies of Countdown 1945 can be purchased through the Reagan Library's Museum Store by visiting reaganlibrary.com/store. And for a robust lineup of additional virtual programming from the Reagan Foundation, please visit us at reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow @Ronald Reagan on Facebook. at Ronald Reagan on Twitter and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.